Scripture reading this morning will be read from the book of 1 Peter, chapter 5, verses 6 through 11. That's 1 Peter, chapter 5, verses 6 through 11. It reads, "Humble yourself, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for somebody to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith, because you know that your brothers throughout the world are undergoing the same kind of sufferings. And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong, firm, and steadfast. To him be the power forever and ever. Amen."
Apologize, a little battery changing last second. So, want to talk a little bit about reaction to what we talked about last week was considering the wonderful works of God and looking up at the sun and the moon, the stars, and how do you respond? Do you, like David, when he talks about in Psalm 8 that he looked up at them and he said, "What are people that you even think about us?" I mean, when you look at how great and how wonderful and glorious the creation of God appears to be, I'm sure most of us have one time or another sat up and stared at the stars at night. Or, you know, a few years ago, we saw the eclipse and almost the odd things that were happening with the shadows of it. It just seems so incredible that it's beyond anything, really, with all of the technology and smarts and power of man, we don't really comprehend all of it still. And so when we consider all of his wondrous works, what's our reaction? Well, the conclusion we looked at last week is really, when we consider all of his wondrous works and that he considers us his children, we are the most important part of all of his works. And that is, we ought to come away with understanding his steadfast love for us will never go away, that will always endure. But our reaction to that wonder and that glory of God ought to be to humble ourselves. And I want to look at, well, 1 Peter was already read for us in verse 6 there. It talks about humble yourselves that basically, God may glorify you, that he can exalt you. And so when we think about the reaction, and I want to look at a few things here in Job, and the idea of being humbled. I want to just start in Job 38 and verse 1. I'm just going to read a few little sections. And it says, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind." So Job and his friends were debating back and forth why all of the tragedy had fallen upon him. Why had he lost everything that he owned? Why had all of his family died except for his wife, his 10 children, and their families? Why had he lost everything? And Job doesn't really know. He basically argues consistently he didn't deserve it, which is true. His friends argue that, well, God's not an unrighteous judge. He wouldn't do something like this if you didn't deserve it. Therefore, you must deserve it. And Elihu comes along at the end, who's not really a friend of theirs. He's a younger man who's upset at both of them. Job for making himself out to be a righteous person, and the friends for not being able to convict Job. But I want you to think about something a little bit more. The reason it all happened was so that God could prove Satan to be a liar. Because the reason it all happened is Satan basically said, the only reason he does that is because you protect him, take care of him, provide for him, and just make all of his stuff grow and he can't be harmed. And he says, and if he didn't have all that protection from you, he'd curse you to your face. Well, Job never did that. The reason God allowed it to happen in part was to prove Satan to be the liar that he is. And so Job went through something to demonstrate a truth about us, about human beings, and our ability to follow God even when it's tough. And God used him for that example and that purpose. And so as they debated and as they went back and forth, and it was Elihu that told them to consider God's wondrous works. And as he speaks a lot about the clouds and the storms, and he talks about, you know, God, you know, appearing in them. And then in chapter 38, God actually talks. He doesn't just, it's not just a voice from nothing. It's a voice that comes from a whirlwind. We call those tornadoes, right? What do we think about when a tornado is coming? What do we think about? We think about run, find shelter. A big storm is coming. And the Lord answers Job from the whirlwind. Can you imagine how fearful that would have been? Not a whole lot different than what happened at Mount Sinai with Moses and all the Israelites when there was a big storm on the mountain and God speaking from it, and people were so terrified that they asked God, after he spoke 10 commandments to them, he asked them, please, just give them to Moses so he can give them to us, because we can't take this. We learn about in the New Testament, in fact, that even Moses was terrified. It was a fearful thing. It was a frightening thing. I've been in a couple of storms where, you know, and where we saw tornadoes happening. You know, some summers I spent in Minnesota with my uncle and his family, and we're out in the water, and then all the sirens go off, and they're yelling for everybody to get out of the lake and then run to some, you know, basement and get into it. And, you know, my brother and I ended up sitting in some stranger's basement for a while until it was clear. My parents had, before cell phones, nobody knew where we were for all those hours. And so I understand the fear. I've lived that, experienced it. That's what Job and them saw. God brings this to them, and then he begins to speak out of it. And then he says to them, and specifically to Job, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. I want you to understand something when he says here. It sounds very confrontational by God, and to some degree it is, but I want you to know what blessing he gave to Job. Because what God is going to do here, and what he just basically said to him is, okay, you and I, we're going to have a back and forth. I'm going to speak, and you're going to answer. Now, I want you to understand, if you have to go back and look at all that Job said, Job asked for this. He wanted to have a situation where they could both make their case. That's what he asked for. He talked about contending with God. See, when we read contending, I think a lot of us think about arguing and fighting. But that's not what it means. It means essentially the idea of to debate. To both to lay out their case and who's right. Almost like I think it's more the word we consider debating. But they were thinking about it more in a legal sense. Both people before a judge kind of making their case. And so God has essentially granted to Job what he wished for. They say, be careful what you wish for, right? And so God is going to make his case. He says, okay, I'm going to question you, and you tell me. And so he says, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? He says, tell me if you understand. What does the earth sit on? Well, the scriptures actually tell us it sits on nothing, hangs in the air. Of course, that's not what most human beings Most creation stories all over the globe, ancient creation stories, have the earth sitting on something. They couldn't even imagine the idea of the earth just hanging out in the middle of nothing. He says, who determined its measurements? Surely you know. You know, I didn't look it up. I don't know at what point human beings decided how big is the earth. We kind of know now. You could probably Google it. Probably find some Google answer, whether it's true or not. Debatable. But we probably have some idea of how big the earth is. But they didn't at this time. Nobody at this time had ever gone around it, had gone from one end to the other to even find that there was an end anywhere. And so he says, on what were its bases sunk? Who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. So when I made all of this stuff, where were you? Do you understand it all? So, obviously, initially, Job's response is going to be, I don't know the answer to any of those things. So he goes on, he talks about a lot of different things. And he says in chapter 39, do you know, I just want to read a few verses there. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Now, the mountain goats, I find them incredibly fascinating. I watched something on Discovery Channel recently about them. I mean, you know, in Yellowstone, when most of the animals leave Yellowstone to come south to get a little bit warmer, that's when the mountain goats come out. Because now it's good for them. It's not cold enough. When it's warmer, they go up higher where it's colder. Nobody goes to. And it's like you look at these goats on four little hoofs, and they're climbing around rocks better than people with hands. It's amazing how they knock each other around. I don't know how they fight, you know, bash each other in the head and not fall off all the time. But they don't. They're up there. We don't really see them a lot. Okay, we saw a few. I remember traveling to Yellowstone years ago. But you see them up in the mountains, and the mountain goats, do you ever see them give birth? No, they're out. They're places where people don't go. He says, do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Now, we probably, in our studies of animals over the last many centuries, we've probably figured out a lot of those things. There's probably scientists that know how long mountain goats' gestation period is before it gives birth. Do you think Job knew that? No. Now, if you ask Job how long a cow or a sheep, he probably knew that. He had those things. They probably had an understanding of that. But you're talking about animals that human beings never really contained. They hadn't tamed in any way. And he says, when they crouch, bring forth their offspring, and are delivered of their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go out and do not return to them. Do you know anything about that? Now, God knows everything about that. He goes on, he talks about donkeys, he talks about wild ox, and he talks about the ostrich. I think the ostrich description is incredibly funny. We know about ostriches, they lay eggs, and it's like they're so stupid, they don't even really know they gave birth to anything, because they just leave it, and they go away. Which he describes perfectly, how ostriches do that. And then he says, but in verse 9, one of the reasons I put the horses up here, I was amazed, had some work done at our house last year. Bunch of guys, a lot of big guys, you know, construction guys, you know, tough guys, and how terrified they were of horses. And we actually have pretty tame horses. This is actually one of the horses that Janae owns. And horses are an interesting animal because they do terrify people. They're huge. You feel like they're going to hurt you. Of course, what's interesting is they have a little teeny brain, and they're not very smart, and they think you're going to hurt them. And so they're afraid of you. Very often, most horses hurt people out of fear, not trying to hurt you. They don't even know how big they are, oftentimes. It's It's a rare horse that actually has kind of a predatory nature to it. Those horses typically are put down, by the way. But 1,200 pounds, and it starts moving around. We had horses when I was little, and I had a healthy fear of horses, though I was very comfortable around horses. I have a very healthy fear of not having my face near their face, because my dad, with our horse, one time, our horse put his head up, caught my dad across the nose and eye, and broke his eye socket. He didn't really understand the eye socket was broken until he blew his nose later that night, and the eye came out. But and then you realize how powerful a horse is. So I always had, like, yeah, I always keep my face away from their head so they can't break my face. But he talks about the might of the horse. Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrifying. He paws in the valley and exults in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He does not turn back from the sword. Upon him rattle the quiver, the flashing spear, and the javelin. With fierceness and rage, he swallows the ground. He cannot stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, he says, aha. He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. Which really fascinating. Have you ever seen the movie of the Secretariat? At the end of the movie at Secretariat, the very last race that he won in the Triple Crown, that the director of that, the movie Secretariat, slows it down as he comes down the home stretch, 31 lengths ahead of the second place horse. And still no horse has come close to his record in that race. And he has, as he slows him down in slow motion, he plays this part of Job. And the narrator is speaking it and talking about the power and majesty and the glory of the horse. Now, you and I can't. The reason we're afraid of them is because of how big and strong they are. I mean, we can run our entire body into them and they're like, oh, okay. It's hard for humans to hurt them. And they can be scary animals. And yet they can be beautiful and tamed. And yet God is saying, do you understand all this stuff? Can you control all these things? But God is implying that he can. God has power over all of these things that seem too powerful for us. And so what's the response? And you come into chapter 40, and the Lord said to Job, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it. So he says, listen, you wanted to argue with me. You wanted to contend with me. Go ahead and answer. And Job's answer is essentially to humble himself. He says, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer. Twice, but I will proceed no further. He says, I'm going to shut up. I didn't know what I was doing. Who am I to try to contend with you? Job gets that with this. Now, God is going to continue to challenge him at this point. But the idea that we could somehow, in the power and glory and majesty of God, act like we could be tough is just foolishness. Everybody who's ever been in the presence of anything resembling the power of God has been afraid for their life. At Mount Sinai, you have Isaiah. Even in a vision, when Isaiah was caught up to the throne room of God, he's terrified and has to be calmed down. Moses was terrified. Everybody in the presence of God, even when just a little, not even an actual presence, but just some of the majesty of his, it's too grand for us. It's too big for us. Our attitude in the glory and grandness of God ought to be to humble ourselves, to realize that we are nothing but dust. Now, I want to think about this example because it kind of helps us understand a little bit about what God was taught doing with the 10 plagues he brought upon Egypt and why he actually talks about that he chose that Pharaoh to bring these plagues. Because that particular Pharaoh had his heart hardened against God, and God hardened his heart against him. The Lord said to Moses, this is the 8th plague, the locusts. Okay? And the Lord said to Moses, go unto Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may show these signs of mine among them, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I have dealt harshly with the Egyptians, and what signs I have done among them, that you may know that I am the Lord. That you may know that I am God. That I am more powerful than these things. These things are just tools and small things in my hands. And so when they first turned the water, the Nile, into blood, the first three, by the way, then the frogs, and then they brought the gnats or the lice. And they're magicians. The Egyptian magicians copied each of them, by the way, for the first three. They had tricks of their own to make it look like they were doing the same thing. And then he brought a swarm of flies. Now, this last summer, we had flies like crazy at our house. We had our doors open a lot. We were working on the house, doing construction. Thousands and thousands of flies in our house. And it was like from a horror show, if you hate flies. And I can't imagine, not only we could get away from it, it was just localized. I can imagine not being able to get away from that and having them everywhere, on everything, in everything. How horrible that would have been. And he's not even half done yet. He comes, the animals sick and die. Then he brings boils upon them. Then hail and locusts. And then darkness such that they can't even see anything. It's like light. They can't even make a fire to light anything. And finally, the firstborn males all die. And at that point, Pharaoh finally relents. Now, he chases him down, tries to kill him anyway. But God chose this Pharaoh to have his heart hardened so that he could demonstrate his power. So Moses could talk about it to their children. How would you have responded to those plagues? I don't think most people would have responded like Pharaoh, would we? We wouldn't have hardened our heart. Because those are the only two real responses to God and his glory and his power. We can either be hardened against it and go, not for me. Or we can humble ourselves and say, he's too great for me. He's far greater than I, and I should listen. Now, in Matthew chapter 8, he talks about this humbleness like a little child. And I want to turn over there. Just look at the first 6 verses there of Matthew 8. This is one of those places where he was upset. I think I have the wrong passage here. I wrote down the wrong one, I think. Is it 18? Anyway. I may have to look that one up really quickly. If anybody has, where he brings the little children in his midst. His disciples tried to have the little children not bother him. Is it 18? Okay. I was a little over there. I'm sure it was the computer's fault, not my fingers. But he says, so at that time the disciples came to Jesus and they're saying, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And calling him a little child, he put in the midst of them. And so they're all debating, I'm better than you. I'm going to be greater than you. I'm going to be more more powerful and stronger. And he brings little children. Now, understand, he brings them a child. He brings them a little child. He's not talking about, the words that they have there kind of imply ages. This is not an older child. You know, we see older children, they do kind of argue like these disciples. I'm better than you. I'm stronger than you. My dad's beat you up. Your dad. They got all kinds of, you know, ways to kind of, you know, say who's better. But little children don't really do that. They just want what's theirs. That's mine. No, you can't play it. That's mine. So everything is about themselves. But he says to them, he says, truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. He's talking to his own disciples. And he's telling them to change. You've got to be different. So when we think about becoming a Christian, I think a lot of mistakes that are made, I think a lot of deceptions that sometimes falls upon Christians, is that becoming a Christian is kind of all that is necessary. Becoming a Christian is not the end. It's the beginning. It's the process. It's the beginning of the process of turning. Turning away from that childlike self, that childlike portion that says, I want everything, everything's about me, everything's for me, it's all mine. To that childlike portion that says, that understands that other people are greater. The children come in. You know, you have little children. They always love to run in and kind of, you know, run and grab mom or grab dad or, you know, see grandma and grandpa and run along and just give them a big hug, right? They're not worried about who's greater. And he says, in this matter, not in every way do you want to be like children, but in this way you want to be like children. Not worrying about who's greater, not worrying about who's better, not worrying about who's stronger, but just humbling yourself before those who love you. And so, he says, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones to believe in me who believes in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. He says, you don't want to hurt the children. Right? I mean, I think people who hurt children, even the people in prison, they're the lowest. That's why you go to prison having hurt children, they're in danger. It's even people in prison consider them the worst. And so, you think about little children. Can we be humble like them? Can we not think of ourselves as something special and just be who we are? Before God, our Father, our Creator, our Master, our Leader, can we have joy like a little child? Now, so the last part I want to go back to is what we read, what was read for us at the beginning in 1 Peter 5. Because in the end of this letter that Peter wrote, he talks about how we should humble ourselves. Now, I just want to understand a little bit about this letter, because we've got a few minutes. You know, when he was writing to them, he writes to the people who are exiles. And in a sense, all Christians are exiles. When we live upon this earth, we are exiles. From our home. Our home isn't here. We sometimes think of our home as being here. We try to make homes here, but they're temporary homes. Our home is with God. Every child wants to go and be with their parents, don't they? They don't want to be off on their own forever. They don't mind running away for a little bit, but at some point they're like, where's mom and dad? And they get scared. And they want to be home. And so when he is writing this letter and telling the people, the Christians that he's writing to, about, you know, hope and living as Christians and suffering as Christians, as he talks about at the in chapter 4. He says, I'm going to actually start in verse 1 of chapter 5 since I got a few extra minutes here. He says, "So I exhort the elders among you as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight not under compulsion but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. Likewise, you who are younger, be subject to the elders. Clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility toward one another. For God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble." And this concept goes back to Pharaoh. What did Pharaoh do? He was proud. He wouldn't put up with it. "And I'm not going to give in. I'm not going to do it." And God had chosen someone who was so hard-headed that he would allow God to produce 10 plagues. And that was important because that 10th plague came with it the Passover, which is a symbol of Christ. There was a reason God wanted to do all 10. And he didn't want a Pharaoh who was going to be soft-hearted enough to stop after one or two. And so he brought all 10 to show and demonstrate his power and to help us understand that not only can he kill all the firstborn, which would imply he could kill all children, but it also means when he didn't kill those who had the blood of the Lamb on their door, that he could also save those who had listened to him. And so, he opposes the proud. He's the enemy of those who rise up in their own pride and consider themselves great. But he gives his grace. He gives his love and his mercy and his kindness and his forgiveness to those who will lower themselves before him and understand their place like a little child. A little child doesn't think, "Well, I run the house." Sometimes they act like it. They don't really think it. And they don't. They just want mom and dad to take care of them, give them the things that they want. And as long as you give them everything they want, they're happy. And so he says, "Humble yourselves," in verse 6, "therefore under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you." So he goes into this kind of things we ought to do, not only to lower ourselves under his mighty hand so that later on he can exalt us, but that implies something. If he's greater, if he's our father, if he's really in charge, why do I act like I'm in charge? Why do I act like I'm the one who makes all the decisions? So when he says, "I'd like you to do this," do we say, "Okay, I'll do that," as an obedient child? Or do we say, "I don't want to do that," like a disobedient child who gets stiff-necked and hates being told what to do? But which child are we? And so he says, "Cast all your anxieties on him, because he cares about you." I think one of the great mistakes that children often make is not talking to their parents. And it kind of grows as we get older. And then sometimes we get into our 20s and realize, you know, I probably should have talked about some of this stuff with my parents because they probably had some wisdom. That instead of talking to my parents, I went and talked to my friends. A bunch of dumb teenagers who also didn't know what they were doing. Because that's what we do. That's what human beings do. And I just heard the saying the other day that, I can't remember where the saying came from, and I might even botch it to some degree, but talked about the idea that experience is wisdom, but real wisdom is learning from the experience of others, not having to do it all yourself. And how many kids find themselves to be that kid, no, until I do it myself, I'm not going to learn. Which is not much different than doubting Thomas, by the way. And he's like, no, unless I have the experience, no, not going to believe it. Very often, we're like that. We don't learn from the experience of others. We have to experience it ourselves because we think we're different. And so understand that he cares about us. Like a parent with a child, they care. They want what's good for us. They want to give us good things. They desire good things for us. And therefore, what are the things that I worry about? Do I talk with him about those things? I need to. I need to pray about those things that worry me and concern me. And I need to give them to God. Because I don't have power to control them. And so he says, be sober-minded. Be watchful. Sober-minded, the word sober often, you know, has the idea of not being drunk. But the reason it has that idea, it doesn't mean that explicitly. But the reason it means the idea to not be intoxicated with some substance is because what happens when you're intoxicated with some psychotropic substance? Alcohol, drugs, and different things. We can't think clearly. Sober-minded means to think clearly. So we are told to think clearly. And in that thinking clearly, we have to be watching. And there is a reason why we have to be watching. Because we have an adversary. That adversary is the devil. Just like with Job. Why did Job go through all that? Because the adversary, the devil, said, oh, he would curse you to your face, you know, if you didn't protect him and help him be, you know, have all this stuff. And God said, that's not true. He didn't tell him that. He simply showed him that. He let Satan do it and to Job to show them that, yes, even people in the worst of circumstances can still remain committed and trusting and faithful to God without cursing him to his face. And he says, you need to be clear-minded all the time so that you can watch and look for those things where he wants to trip you and trap you and entice you. You know, why do we put cheese on a mousetrap? We don't want mice around, right? And so we tempt them to come into this thing that will kill them. What is the devil doing? Why is he enticing us? The devil is putting out enticements that bring us into human traps. That we might get caught in sin. That we might be cast away from God. Because that's what he does. It's what he has always done. That has been his intention from the very beginning. He has been a liar and the father of lies from the very beginning of mankind. And he says he prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Gotta find that weak one, right? Why do they, even the lions don't go into the big herd, because even lions can get hurt by, you know, some of the animals out there and their antlers or their, you know, they're big. Sometimes they're bigger than the lions. So the lions pick off the ones on the outside that are weaker. They can't save themselves. And you and I can very often be that person if we're not careful. And the reason that we often become that, it's kind of the opposite of the animal kingdom, where the small little weak ones end up out on the outsides and they get eaten. Well, it's our pride that often makes us think we don't need the group. We don't need other people. We don't need God. We don't need other people's help because I can do it on my own. We don't need to cast our cares upon Him. We don't need to talk to our parents. We don't need to other people because I've got this. I'm smart enough. I'm capable enough. I don't need anything. That's kind of a, in many ways, I think when you look at stories and cinema of American culture, the idea that somebody is a strong individual and not needing anybody else's help is prevalent in all Western culture. Now, it's not prevalent in every culture on the earth, by the way. But in American culture, we have revered that silent, lone person who comes in and saves the day and walks off alone into the sunset. It's stupid, by the way. It's ungodly, and it's not true. Our culture feeding us through the devil a pack of lies that he wants us to accept because then it makes us easier to fall. And he's looking for ways to destroy us. He says, resist him firm in your faith, firm in your trust in God, knowing the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. One thing is important to understand, because one of the tricks or the deceptions that the devil puts in us sometimes is that what we have gone through, nobody else has really ever gone through. All the difficult things that happened to us, boy, nobody's had it as bad as me. And it's just not true. It's never true. Even if you've gone through a lot, and I know a lot of people who've gone through a lot. But notice what I said, I know a lot of people who've gone through a lot. Because there's no way to equate suffering, but everybody is going to suffer. But sometimes we think our suffering is unique and nobody else understands, and it isolates us further. And he says, and after you have suffered a little while, now, this has been a verse that has always perplexed me from the time I was a brand new Christian. Verse 10, and after you have suffered a while, the God of all grace who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. But the beginning, why after a while we've suffered? And how long is that while? Why doesn't he just do all those things when I first become a Christian? Why do I have to still suffer a while before I'm restored and confirmed and strengthened and established? I have guesses, I should say. I don't know. Sometimes I think if we don't suffer, sometimes we kind of think, you know, we kind of get deceived or entitled. But we're all going to suffer. In different ways, and a bunch of varied ways, and they're not going to be unique to us. Other people are going to go through the exact same things we go through. And he says, "But know this, that you might suffer through things for a while." Wonder how long a while is. You ever wonder that? How long is a while to God? How long is a while to you? Day or two? A week maybe? A month seems way too long. Right? A number of us have suffered this last month or so with some kind of flu bug. I keep thinking I'm done, and I keep feel like it's not done yet. I feel like for 2 weeks I have felt fine, essentially, but something has still felt wrong. And my voice won't come back completely. And it's like, I don't know why. Just keeps lingering and lingering. It seems too long. When it comes to the flu, I expect it to be within a week and to have it be gone. I've become accustomed to that amount of suffering. Okay, I'm going to lay in bed for a week. A little vacation from work. No, a month is too long. But how long is a while for God? Well, sometimes it's years. And sometimes it's the rest of your lifetime. Can we suffer for a while before we are established? Yeah, we can. And you know why we can? Because God is great. And God is awesome. And God will exalt us in due time. If you're here and you need anything, we're going to have a song. So like, what's the song again? 450. We're going to sing that to close out this morning. And if you're in need in any way, we want to aid you if we are able. If we can help you, if we can study with you, if we can pray for you, if we can just comfort you, we can hear you and the sufferings you might be going through. If there's anything that you need, please let us know what it is as together we stand and sing.